Coming up, Lucky Severson looks at the ethics of private for-profit companies that oversee probation. And Kim Lawton on the continuing legacy of the Chabad Lubavitch Rebbe Menachem Mendel Schneerson 20 years after his death. Plus, comfort dogs who soothe the pain of people who are hurting.
Dogs are part of God's creation.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Hari Srinivasan, sitting in for Bob Abernethy. As the U.S. and international groups increased humanitarian aid to Iraq, U.N. officials raised grave concerns that crimes against humanity were being committed by Islamic State militants, or ISIS. This week, the U.N. Human Rights Chief accused ISIS of ethnic and religious cleansing, citing their brutal attacks against minorities, including Christians and Yazidis. Those views were shared by the Syria Catholic Patriarch Yunan, who returned from a trip to northern Iraq with a delegation of Catholic and Orthodox church leaders. Yunan said the actions of ISIS were, quote, pure and simple religious cleansing and attempted genocide. Meanwhile, memorial services were held for the journalist James Foley, who was killed by ISIS militants in Iraq last week. A prayer service was also held in his memory at Marquette University, his alma mater. Foley was a devout Catholic. Religious leaders from across the nation were among those attending this week's funeral services for Michael Brown, the unarmed African-American teenager shot by a police officer in Ferguson, Missouri. Several faith groups have been gathering signatures for petitions advocating full accountability in the Brown case and systemic changes to police procedures nationwide. Clergy have also been urging more training in nonviolence for those who want to protest. Growing alarm this week about the spread of Ebola in West Africa. The World Health Organization said the number of infected people could reach 20,000. More than 1,500 have died from the outbreak so far. Many of the cases are in Liberia, and faith-based relief officials there say that Ebola has induced a citywide panic in Monrovia, the nation's capital, where medical facilities and staff are in short supply. A former Vatican ambassador to the Dominican Republic is facing possible extradition by several countries after being accused of sex crimes against children. Earlier this year, Joseph Wesolowski was found guilty and defrocked by a Vatican court for sexually abusing young boys while in the Dominican Republic. He has yet to be charged in the Dominican Republic, however. This week, the Vatican said that Wesolowski has lost his diplomatic immunity status and could be extradited. Wesolowski has appealed his defrocking. Now, the ethics of probation for profit. In many jurisdictions in the U.S., courts appoint private, for-profit probation companies to collect fines and oversee the conduct of individuals accused of violations. But sometimes people with relatively small fines end up with fees and interest charges that balloon to amounts they cannot afford. And as Lucky Severson reports, this can lead to months or even years in jail.
After his brother died, Clifford Hayes was homeless, so he went to the sheriff's office for permission to stay at a Salvation Army shelter for one night.
I didn't know they had a warrant for my arrest. I went there to go get me a shelter clearance, and they locked me up.
The warrant was for a speeding ticket he'd received several years earlier. A private probation company appointed by the court said the fine had not been paid. Hayes says the fine plus the company's fees had ballooned to a couple thousand dollars, money he didn't have.
Have you been in any other trouble besides
no,
the speeding ticket?
No, sir.
That's it?
That's it.
I was shocked that he would be in jail and supposedly would have stayed in jail for a year or two on these charges.
Jack Long is a self-proclaimed conservative Republican attorney in Augusta, Georgia, who is representing several probationers free of charge. He is outraged because, he says, a 1983 Supreme Court case ruled that people on probation cannot be jailed because they can't afford to pay a fine. Caroline Isaacs is with the American Friends Service Committee, a Quaker organization.
These are folks that, in many cases, couldn't pay like a $200 fine or ticket. They're put on probation. They have to pay interest on what they owe, and they have to pay that company for the privilege of being supervised by them. It's like a payday loan. They end up paying 10 times over. And these are people that are poor to begin with.
Chris Albanlaki is with Human Rights Watch. He authored an extensive report called Profiting from Probation.
The issue is that the courts are hiring these people not really to act as probation officers, but to act as debt collectors. The fact that they're called probation officers is, in many courts, really nothing more than a legal fiction. It's not just, it's not ethical, and it's not in keeping with people's basic rights.
These are my bills that I have to pay now. These are brand new bills.
These are hospital bills,
medical bills.
Clifford Hayes has lupus, a disease that has taken three members of his family. He receives a monthly supplemental security income check, SSI, for $720. His rent is $400. His medication costs at least $70 a month. He lives in fear that he'll be jailed again for the old speeding ticket if Jack Long is not there to protect him.
If someone violates the rules of society, they need to be punished. But the punishment need to have some, if it's going to be based on a fine, it had to be based on the person's ability to pay. If they don't have the ability to pay, they can pick up trash on the streets or they can have some community service.
Jack Long says his probation cases have all been with a for-profit company called Sentinel Offender Services. But there are many other private probation companies out there.
I have learned that it's a lot more widespread than I ever thought, and the abuses are more prevalent than I ever thought.
We requested an interview with the sheriff of Richmond County here in Augusta, but we're told that Sheriff Roundtree had no comment. We contacted Sentinel Offender Services for the company side on this issue and have not heard back. In previous public statements, Sentinel officials have said that their supervision helps offenders meet the terms of their probation. Sentinel also offers English as a second language classes and guidance counseling. Tom Barrett has no gripe with Sentinel, and he was under their supervision for longer than he would care to remember.
Sentinel, now, they were professional, and I didn't really have a problem. They were doing their job.
Thomas Barrett is an individual that had a college education. He was a pharmacist by training. He was in the Army. Life was going on with him, and unfortunately had an alcohol problem.
And I was real depressed, and I just said, you know, I want a beer. And I walked by this convenience store, and I walked in there.
So Barrett was arrested for shoplifting a $2 can of beer.
He was incarcerated, and the judges told him he could have to go on electronic monitoring if he wanted to be released from jail.
Electronic monitoring costs about $12 a day, and he would have had to install a landline in his home for the monitor to work, all requiring money he didn't have.
Basically, they said I was going to be locked up until I could make all these arrangements. And I'm thinking, if I'm locked up, it's going to be more difficult to make these arrangements, plus I have no money.
Finally, a friend convinced the judge to allow him out of jail long enough to make enough money to stay out of jail.
My only income was food stamps and selling plasma, and so I was falling behind. And the probation officer said, when you get up to about $500 behind, you get locked up again. And so I got $500 behind and I got locked up again.
Altogether, he was locked up three times.
I know the jailing cost $50 a day, and I think he was probably in jail for at least 60 days or 70 days, so probably over $3,500.
The cost for his jailing was passed on to the taxpayers.
A lot of courts don't have the funds to pay for their own operations. A lot of courts are under tremendous pressure from local public officials not to be a burden on the taxpayer, to generate revenue instead of costing revenue.
Caroline Isaac says local courts are turning to private for-profit companies to save money. More than 5 million Americans are on probation.
But aren't they saving the taxpayers' money?
I have seen no evidence of that thus far.
It's estimated that private probation companies in Georgia alone collect fees of over $40 million annually.
I'm surprised it's that low. I think it's higher than that.
Higher than $40 million?
Yes, and I don't think you can know because they don't disclose. They're not required to disclose everything they collect.
A lot of companies provide quarterly bonuses to their employees based on how much money they take in. And I think that's a perfect example of how these probation officers who work for these private companies are often being explicitly pushed in the direction not of being probation officers in the traditional sense of the term, but in just being very effective at squeezing money out of the people who come into their offices.
They have an incentive to basically keep people on probation as long as possible to sell as many services as they can.
Caroline Isaac says faith groups that have been involved in incarceration for profit issues are now taking a closer look at for-profit probation.
Even beyond, you know, the basic ethical conundrum of incarceration for profit, there are other fundamental faith principles. Redemption and forgiveness really are falling by the wayside when we profitize these functions.
Jack Long is taking 13 probation cases against Sentinel before the Georgia Supreme Court. If he wins, it could severely restrict the profits of companies like Sentinel.
The judicial branch of government does not need to be involved in helping a company make a profit.
Among the cases before the court are Clifford Hayes and Tom Barrett, who has quit drinking for over 6 months.
I'm ashamed of what I did. I made a mistake, but I need to move on.
Tom Barrett says he forgives the people who have given him such a hard time, but cannot forgive the system. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson in Augusta, Georgia.
In other news, thousands of American Muslims are making preparations for their upcoming pilgrimage to Mecca, or Hajj, which falls this year on the first week of October. 25 U.S. Muslim groups sent a letter to Secretary of State John Kerry asking for protection during their journey to Mecca. Last year, Shiite Muslims from Detroit said they were attacked and threatened with death by a group of Sunni Muslims during the Hajj, but received little help from either Saudi or U.S. authorities. The State Department said they take all threats against U.S. citizens seriously and urged pilgrims to register their whereabouts with the State Department. There were Jewish celebrations in Mumbai, India this week. Nariman House, a Jewish community center run by the Chabad-Lubavitch movement, reopened nearly 6 years after it was attacked by Pakistani gunmen. Six people were killed. Chabad leaders said the reopened center will be a beacon of light and hope that evil will not prevail. The Chabad-Lubavitch movement is the best known of several ultra-Orthodox Hasidic groups that began in the 18th century. Chabad members emphasize outreach to Jews around the world, a task given by their late spiritual leader, Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson. The Rebbe, 20 years after his death, Schneerson continues to have a profound influence, as Kim Lawton reports.
In Queens, New York, thousands of members of the Chabad-Lubavitch movement have come to the gravesite of their spiritual leader, Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson, the Rebbe. They pray and leave notes and wishes, which are usually torn up after they're offered. Schneerson died in 1994, and 2 decades later, his followers still want to be near him.
There is this feeling that the Rebbe had a close connection to God, so people beseech him to intervene, so to speak, on their behalf. And they feel, when they go to his gravesite, they feel that they are more connected at that holy place.
Rabbi Joseph Telushkin is author of a new biography of Schneerson titled Rebbe. He documents how Schneerson's legacy continues to touch Orthodox and non-Orthodox Jews and non-Jews as well. In the 20 years since Schneerson's death, the Chabad movement has tripled in size. Telushkin, who's Orthodox but not a member of Chabad, calls Schneerson the most influential rabbi in modern history.
There is no other comparable rabbinic figure in modern times who had such a reach.
Schneerson was the seventh Rebbe of the Hasidic Lubavitcher movement, which began in the 18th century. He was born in Ukraine and came to the U.S. in 1941. He settled with other Lubavitchers in Crown Heights, Brooklyn, and succeeded his father-in-law as Rebbe in 1951. Schneerson's personal charisma attracted many, as did his teachings.
The Rebbe took the deepest concepts of Judaism and explained it to the questions that are bothering people today.
Rabbi Beryl Bell first encountered Schneerson as a student at Yale University when he read something the Rebbe had written in a weekly Chabad publication.
I was absolutely astounded, just in terms of the scholarship and the relevance and the importance to living your daily life. I couldn't believe it. I asked the people that I was with, it was a bunch of yeshiva students, I said, something like this comes out every week? To me, it seemed like somebody's magnum opus.
From the beginning, Schneerson's goal was Jewish outreach, as he put it, to ignite the soul of every Jew.
The Rebbe inaugurated the first attempt in all of Jewish history to reach every Jewish community and every Jew in the world. No one was regarded as insignificant, and this was very important.
Schneerson instructed his emissaries, known as Shlichim, to bring Judaism to every community, no matter how remote. Today, there are more than 4,000 couples running Chabad centers in 49 states and some 80 countries.
The Rebbe understood that any one law, any one ritual, any one ethical act could be that step that could bring someone on a path back to Judaism. And by the way, he thought, though, that the step had value even if the person didn't take it further.
Today, Lubavitchers continue carrying out Schneerson's marching orders, aided greatly by modern technology.
When you look online for Jewish institutions, Chabad is probably the first thing you find.
David Denemark is a 23-year-old German university student who says he's faced anti-Semitism in Berlin. He grew up in a completely secular environment, but decided he wanted to reconnect with his Jewish roots. In a Facebook search, he found out about this Chabad Jewish Summer Fellowship program in the Catskills.
We pray not to close your eyes and to pray by heart, but to look at the letters.
At gender-separated camps, Jewish college or grad students get 6 weeks of intensive training in sacred texts and mystical teachings. Men learn how to pray and wear tefillin and tzitzit, the religious fringes.
They make you proud to be a Jew and not to be ashamed. Go outside with a kippah, show your tzitzit, don't be scared, don't be afraid.
Women also study text and pray, and they learn practical skills such as how to make challah, the traditional bread at Sabbath dinners.
Very often, they're going to other countries and exploring other religions and haven't given themselves an opportunity to discover or explore their own religion.
Yusefa Jalal's mother is Jewish and her father a Pakistani Christian. She came to the program in 2011 and is now a counselor because, she says, it transformed her spiritual life.
I didn't have much of a Jewish education at all. When I came here, I learned a lot of new things and I was amazed. I knew that this was the truth. I knew this is the way that I wanted to follow.
The program began 30 years ago with Schneerson's blessing, and its leaders believe they're still carrying out his vision.
Other Hasidic masters and other Hasidic rabbis, where they said, listen, all you have to do is study the Torah and teach the Torah. The rabbi said, no, you have a talent in art. You have a talent in music. You have a talent in medicine. Yes, I want you to get the foundations of Torah, but then go back to that profession, because everything leads to God.
This is what he loved, you know, Jews from all over having the opportunity to just come, experience in an open environment, in a non-judgmental environment, learning on their own pace, taking it wherever they go.
Program director Rabbi Chaim Shochet says Schneerson was a vibrant presence in his family's life. As a child, he attended the Rebbe's popular mass meetings called Verbrengen.
You know, often people thought it was just charisma, it was just a lot of fluff and singing and dancing. And, you know, when the Rebbe would no longer be there, it would kind of dissipate. And that's what they asked 20 years later, how's it all going on? What I think they failed to recognize, it was substance. He was teaching. He was communicating. He was a master teacher.
Telushkin says many of Schneerson's teachings still have universal appeal.
One was approaching people with non-judgmental love, and not just having a love of people, but it always remained focused on the individual. Anything worth doing is worth doing now. The Rebbe would not delay things. The Rebbe also had the capacity to disagree without being disagreeable. And what was the secret of that? He focused on what he held in common with other people. That's exactly what most human beings don't do.
For Jews, Schneerson stressed the importance of doing good deeds and fulfilling commandments in order to usher in redemption and the coming of the Messiah, Moshiach. The movement still believes that.
Is Moshiach a part of my world? Absolutely. I believe that, you know, any one single deed that any person does could be the deed that brings Moshiach.
Because of his spirituality and popularity, some Chabad followers saw Schneerson himself as a potential Messiah, and that belief persists in some quarters.
To be truthful, there are some Chabadniks, some people within his movement, who believe that he will return from the dead. They're hoping that when the dead are revived, he'll be one of them and he'll be revealed as the Messiah. I don't see that affecting any people's behaviors on a day-to-day basis. When that day will come that the Messiah comes, we'll find out. But I think it has greatly receded in significance.
Although several of Schneerson's close associates provide administrative leadership for the Chabad movement, no new Rebbe was named after his death.
What's also significant is that the movement has undergone its greatest growth without a leader. Maybe the time will come when the movement will find a figure who seems to have that same unifying charisma that the Rebbe had. But in the meantime, it's working.
Many Lubavitchers say Schneerson continues to lead them through his teachings. They believe, as Chabad's key text, the Tanya, teaches, the essence of a Rebbe doesn't end with death.
It says in Tanya that the influence is even stronger after the physical presence is not visible than before, because during the physical lifetime, the soul was limited to a body. Afterwards, the soul is free to affect things without the constraints of a body.
Lubavitchers also say they are united by the knowledge that they still haven't achieved the mandate Schneerson gave them to reach every Jew.
One Jew lost is one Jew too many. We have to reach out. Children in camps, students on their campuses, communities, build synagogues and community centers. Wherever Jews are, at whatever stage, whatever country, we have to reach out to them and bring them on board.
But it's not an easy task. Growing numbers of U.S. Jews, especially young Jews, describe themselves as religiously unaffiliated.
How can you find what Judaism can still offer people to give meaning to their lives? In the final analysis, that's what human beings are looking for. They want to feel that they're part of something more important than just themselves. How do you do it? And that's what the challenge will be.
Chabad members believe that challenge is precisely why Schneerson's legacy is more important than ever. I'm Kim Lawton in New York.
Finally, as the community in Ferguson, Missouri continues to reel from the events surrounding the death of Michael Brown, special visitors this week tried to bring some solace. Lutheran Church Charities, LCC, brought in its canine comfort dog ministry. The group's mission is to provide comfort and compassion to hurting people. The specially trained dogs often visit hospitals and nursing homes, but they're also brought to sites where tragedies have occurred. LCC President Tim Hetzner explains their ministry.
People many times, all ages, will talk to a dog before they'll talk to a person. After a couple seconds of petting the dog, people start sharing why they're there or what they're thinking or some of their fears. But, you know, through all of that, it brings a smile to their face, some hope into their day. And if they want, we will pray with them, if they would like that. Dogs are part of God's creation, a very gifted part of His creation with their sixth sense of empathy, to sense someone who is hurting. I can't tell you how many times our dogs, and they're trained not to be aggressive with people, but will nudge the handler to go see someone, and we'll invite them over, and it's somebody that is struggling. Dogs sense that in people. All of our dogs have a business card, and on their business card is a picture of the dog, and it has a Bible verse. Here's Ruthie's, Ephesians 4:2. They all have Facebook pages, Twitter accounts, and email, which isn't just being cute. It's a way to continue to minister to and to connect with people and many times people will share things that they're going through or will ask for prayers through the Facebook page. You know, I have not found in the Gospels yet where Jesus ever invited someone to synagogue or temple. But I do see all over the place where Jesus calls us to go out. And it's not just go out, but he always says where to start. And you start with the lowliest and those that are hurting. And those that are in the lowly places, and those that are suffering. And that's what we do as the hands and the feet of Christ.
That's our program for now. I'm Hari Srinivasan. You can follow Religion and Ethics News Weekly on Twitter and Facebook, and watch anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. And visit the website, where there's always much more, and where you can also listen to or watch each program. Join us at PBS.org. As we leave you, more from the Chabad Lubavitch.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.